Almost everyone I've ever worked with, I'm going to clarify, almost meaning 100%. 100% of the people I've ever worked with, and certainly in my own journey, unresolved trauma, spiritual disconnection, and toxic shame were such the root of it. And you talked about big T trauma, and I know there's a framework about big T, little T trauma. I actually am not a massive fan of that, because it really then becomes comparing, because I've met so many people that don't have what they consider to be some big traumatic event. But when we start exploring, it's like this one thing that might have felt really insignificant to one person was just this major moment.
Are you ready to unlock conversations of resilience, triumph, and transformation? Well, you're in the right place. This is the Knocking Doors Down podcast. Your host, Jason LaChance, where we dive deep into the journeys of those who have overcome life's toughest challenges and are sharing their experience, knowledge, and insight into how you can do just the same. If you're checking out the podcast for the first time, hit that subscribe button on whatever platform you're listening on, or hey, if you're on YouTube, hit that subscribe button, leave a thumb up and a comment on the video, because not only do I see it, but so do my guests. And my guest is TJ Woodward, a revolutionary recovery expert, best-selling author, inspirational speaker, and addiction treatment specialist who's helped countless people through his simple yet powerful teachings. He's also the creator of the Conscious Recovery Method, which is a groundbreaking and effective approach to viewing and treating addiction. TJ and I discuss a variety of topics, including how our purpose is to be who we are, not what we do. We also talk about our past experiences and how they determine so much of how we interpret situations, which rolled into how our memory of traumatic events isn't always accurate. We talk how life can become pretty simple when you tap into your true nature, and it's not only our behavior that changes the brain, but consciousness itself. Check out this great episode of Knocking Doors Down with TJ Woodward. TJ Woodward, thank you for joining me on Knocking Doors Down.
Thank you, Jason. I'm looking forward to our conversation. I'm so grateful to be here. And I know you love gratitude, so we start with that.
Right? Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, that's how I start my day. So I like to start my conversations by asking three things you're grateful for today.
You know, it's interesting. I promise I'll answer it, but I kind of looked at gratitude and looked at different layers of gratitude. And I have this framework that I call the three layers or three levels of gratitude. It's grateful for, grateful in, and grateful as. And as I shifted from grateful for into grateful as, in other words, can I be the frequency of gratitude wherever I go in every situation? It makes it a little bit harder for me to say what I'm grateful for. I just wanted to say that, but I can list so many things I'm grateful for. I'm grateful for my wonderful husband. I'm grateful for our amazing dog. I'm grateful for my recovery. And honestly, the thing I'm the most grateful for, I would say, that is coming up at this moment is the ability to have a purpose, to know my purpose, and to have constructed my life around that purpose. And as cliche as it sounds, if we do what we love, we never work a day in our life. And that's how I feel.
I agree with you. And let's start on purpose, because I've been getting into conversations with people that are lost on purpose or misguided in what it is. And it seems to me the holdup for a lot of people is that connection to the story they still tell themselves about themselves, and that purpose has to be this big grandiose thing that hits you and all of a sudden you're off to the races and life is good. And it's like, I'm still figuring out, like, I'm so open to the different things and opportunities that get presented to me that, okay, is this something I embrace? Is this not for me? I don't know. What about you?
Well, for me, I always thought purpose was an action. I always thought it was a role that I played, or if I could just figure out what was mine to do, I would be on purpose or living on purpose. And somewhere along the line, I started asking myself the question, I wonder if purpose is something much more internal, or if it's a quality. As a matter of fact, I facilitate a little group on purpose, and I tell people, I guarantee you will know your purpose in 90 minutes, which of course is provocative, but it really is getting in touch with who we've come here to be, not what we've come here to do. And once we're in touch with that being, then the doing becomes a natural outpicturing of it. And that's a really different way than I was programmed, because from a very early age, it's like, you know, go to the school, get the degree, get the relationship, figure out your work life. And like, it's really much more about how we're being than what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, and you bring up such a good point about, you know, I thought recently back about education and got into a conversation with a gentleman that's become a mentor. And I forget what I had said, but he went, of course you're thinking that way, because you are always sitting and doing some sort of work to get some sort of validation, be it an A plus all the way to F. Like you're still in that. It was like, what does that effing have to do with who you are? And I was like, oh yeah, because I'm not my grade. I'm not the perspective of that other person. I'm my compassion, my love, my sincerity. And I still fight that. I fight that. I have that big subconscious thing still there that I still am working on.
Well, you talked about a couple of things that are so important to me and such an integral part of my work because of my own life journey. And you talked about kind of like the stories that we still have about ourselves. And there's this narrative that many of us are carrying around, but it's actually much deeper than a narrative. It's really a vibration. And for many of us, we have some traumatic experiences early in life, and we start deciding some huge things about ourselves before our brains even developed, quite frankly. And we end up carrying this energy with us everywhere we go. And in my case, I'm not lovable and I'm not worthy were two that just were at the core of my being. And I just kept finding myself in relationships and in work situations that were confirming the core false belief. And I thought, if I can just get to that next thing, right? Find the perfect partner, find the perfect house, find the perfect job. So it was this very outside in life. And at some point I realized the deeper work is really looking at where those core false beliefs originated and how we start to heal them, because the unconscious is running the show. And if we're not aware of it, we just think it's fate, or we think it's just our destiny.
Right. This is my lot in life, right? What was that? Right. C-3PO? This is my lot in life. And it's hard to struggle through. Like I shared when we first started, you know, that I grew up in a home of addiction and I was a pretty late bloomer with substance use. But eventually I did fall into a subconscious state that this is the norm and this is what I deserve.
Yeah.
And I know you've worked with so many people that probably that's the same story.
Yeah. And I find that there's that. And then if we kind of explore a little deeper, it's usually that the substance, whatever the addictive behavior is, if we use that term, whatever that outside thing we're trying to attach ourselves to, whether that's shopping or sex, or I mean, it can be so many different things, substance, we're really trying to heal something that feels broken within. So this outside in life, it's like, for many of us, myself included, the first time I used weed and alcohol, it was like a very beautiful thing. It was like, oh, thank God I found this, right? So it was definitely a solution to something and it was managing something. And of course, we know it doesn't really keep working that way. And ultimately, we have to start living from the inside out if we want true satisfaction and happiness.
Yeah. Well, and as you lay it out, you know, I mean, the root causes of addictive behavior, unresolved trauma, spiritual disconnect, and that toxic shame.
Yeah.
And the irony that can come with it is, I don't know if you've had this with some people that you've had conversations with, it didn't seem like their life had, they had big T traumas, but maybe a series of little ones. And then when they fell into the substance use, that was what really grew a lot of those traumatic moments, the spiritual disconnect. I know for me, it was the hugest spiritual disconnect. I know I was spiritually broken, dead, disconnected, didn't have a desire to connect, didn't think I was worthy of that connection, along with the toxic shame.
Yeah. And so my experience is those three things are at the root of almost, well, when I say almost everyone I've ever worked with, I'm going to clarify almost meaning 100%. 100% of the people I've ever worked with, and certainly in my own journey, unresolved trauma, spiritual disconnection, and toxic shame were such the root of it. And you talked about big T trauma, and I know there's a framework about big T, little T trauma. I actually am not a massive fan of that because it really then becomes comparing, because I've met so many people that don't have what they consider to be some big traumatic event. But when we start exploring, it's like this one thing that might have felt really insignificant to one person was just this major moment. I remember I couldn't tie my shoes in kindergarten. I mean, it seems ridiculous to say it, but the truth is I can still remember the feeling. I remember just starting to feel shame and just shutting down because everyone else was tying their shoes and the teacher sent me home with this little board with two shoes on it. And I remember reciting to myself, I'm so stupid, the whole way home. And like that would be, for most people, that would be a little T trauma. But for me, it was a massive thing because it's not so much what happens, but what we decide about ourselves and the world that actually creates the traumatic event. So for one, that would be a day they'd never remember. For me, it was this pivotal life-changing moment.
It's so interesting how the brain works that way. I recently have been having to explore some feelings around some things when I was still in my alcoholism, when my kids were little, and some of the decisions that I made. And I don't feel like the shame is sitting in my body per se. I'm not getting the same kind of tension, but I'm just, I'm exploring what that is. Is there something spiritual? Is there still an amends that needs to be made? You know, some of these things, they still come up, but I will tell you, I'm one of those people that they help real quick. And it's like, oh yeah, remember how quickly you go back down that road if invasive thoughts enter or the shameful thoughts.
Right, exactly. And their thoughts and their frequency, and something can happen. I love the way Bessel van der Kolk frames trauma. He said, trauma doesn't show up as a memory, it shows up as a reaction.
Mm.
Right? So we have these traumatic events. Because of these traumatic events, we develop what I call core false beliefs. And I say I because I add the word false, lies about ourselves and the world. We're carrying them around. That becomes the operating system. And then we have these experiences that seem to confirm the core false belief. And we develop these strategies to manage it. So someone will just say one thing and boom, either it's anger or we shut down or we retreat, fight, flight, or freeze, and now we have or fawn, which is basically, let me take care of you and not look at my own feelings. Mm-hmm. And so it really isn't so much about remembering what happened. It's more about becoming aware of what's alive within us now. Whoa, I notice I have a big reaction. Let me tend to that. And really, the emotion is there because it's an internal guidance system wanting us to pay attention. But for many of us, especially those of us who have had any kind of relationship with an addiction, we've been running from our feelings for so long. So learning how to just be present with them takes some time to learn how to do.
Yeah, I want to dig into movie here in a minute.
Okay.
But you said something I have never heard. The fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. That caretaker, that gave me the chill, because that was me. I will solve my problems by meeting all your needs.
Yeah, and that I did not create that fawn. I don't know where that happened. I just picked it up recently, like, oh, we have a fourth one now. Because it used to be we just said fight or flight. And I was very much about saying freeze because that was my experience. I remember being a little kid, and when things got scary, I would go in my room and close the door and just check out. And as an adult, anything that felt intense would activate that trauma response, and I would just find myself becoming numb, checking out. So I was definitely a freeze. I had my moments with fawning as well, of course.
Let me ask you, as someone that I'm a freeze person too,
yeah.
And I still have to. I have moments where it's challenged. It's obviously still there in me to choose my reaction and how I'm going to respond to situations. But I found it for me when people were like, I remember some early meetings, a gentleman asked me, what are you running from, brother? And I said, no, I'm trying to run to something.
Mm.
Because I was good at just naturally being numb. It was, I was looking to have a feeling, that excitement, that everything else, that nice story that I went from the guy that no one would talk to the most charming guy in the bar that will go up and talk to the most attractive woman. So yes. For me, it was a running to feeling nature.
You know, it's interesting. It can be either one. It can be I'm running from or running toward. In other words, I want to feel more of this or less of this. And they're really both actually two sides of the same coin, right? I'm just trying to change the way I feel. Either this feeling is so intense, I want to numb it out, or this sense of numbness is like I'm really in this existential pain of living with my numbness and I want to feel something. Either way, it's really about manipulating feelings externally. And that's why in recovery, sometimes I'll hear people say something like, well, I feel really sad today. And then someone well-meaning will say, well, have you worked a step? Have you called your sponsor? Have you gone to a meeting? Have you talked to your therapist? And there's a subtle and sometimes not so subtle message that it's not okay to be sad. And really what it is, it's like, oh, welcome sadness. For many of us, we haven't felt it in so long, right? And the cliche is you're going to feel better when you get into recovery. You're going to feel everything better. But even in recovery, we can, you know, dodge those feelings, run from those feelings, develop all sorts of strategies. So recovery ultimately is about learning how to be present and lean in. And I think that's the number one recovery tool. Let me simply be present with myself without trying to manipulate it.
Knocking Doors Down by Carlos Vieira. Now available wherever you get audiobooks.
I wasn't done partying, and I didn't want the binge to end. I think I knew that when I finally got home, I'd have to face what I had done, and I wasn't ready to do that. Being responsible for my actions wasn't something I was looking forward to. I had abandoned my wife and baby, my family, and my business. I wanted to avoid the shame of returning to what I had left behind. Even though I was not yet going home, I wasn't sure I had enough resources to continue the binge.
Click the link in the podcast description to find out more.
Well, I know it was it was interesting for you where you were talking. I watched something with you recently talking about not wanting to be a step creator guy. But you did, yeah. And it was an acronym that stood out for me because, hey, I went to film and television school, and so it's nice. A movie. I would like to explore that with you.
Yeah, it's my third book. Let me see if I can point the right direction. That one, Conscious Creation. And I did promise myself, I said, I'll never be that person that creates the multi-step process. But lo and behold, I realized the truth is I created this five-step process and then realized if I just changed one word, it'll make an acronym and it's very appropriate. And it's Conscious Creation is the book. And in my many years of working with people, and again, I'll say, and certainly true in my journey, a lot of people want to start creating their life with the intention setting, the goal setting. And there are so many steps before that in my experience, because if we're carrying around the past with us, if we haven't done enough of our healing, we're just going to keep replicating the same story over and over again. And the analogy is simple. We're holding a movie projector onto a blank canvas or a blank screen, if you will, and we're creating the movie of our life. We think it's happening out there, but the truth is we're the one creating it based on the core false beliefs, the vibration, and the internal dialogue and narrative that we're carrying.
Yeah. And I've seen this so many times, and with myself is that asking someone, it doesn't matter. I was at a meeting and a gentleman, oh, this and that, how it is. And I've been around this person and their family. And I go, yeah, I don't know if that's exactly how it happened. You might right. you might want to check your personal lenses on this, that this is how you took this in. Well, they were being standoffish. It was like, yeah. No, they asked a question from my perspective that it was really good and a polite way to ask, maybe a little invasive where you could have said, ooh, that's a boundary. I'm not really going to talk about that. But it turned into a really bad situation quick. And it's so interesting how, like you lay out, our past and our response system determines so much of our experiences.
That's right. I remember getting when I was in early in recovery and I was just starting to dive into like doing some work with my past. I called my two sisters and I remember asking them to tell their versions of some things in our childhood. And I knew enough at that point that I would get different versions. But what was really surprising to me was totally different stories. Completely different conclusions. I was like, Dad was never home. He was busy with all these people who weren't my mom. I had this whole story. And my younger sister is like, are you kidding? He was home for dinner every night. We went on these amazing vacations every year. And I'm like, interesting. Totally different conclusion. And then based on those conclusions, it does become the lens at which we look at life through. So like I decided in the midst of all of that, that somehow I was unlovable and that wasn't her core decision. So we had every single experience in our life is colored through the lens. And that's the great news, because if we understand we're doing it, then we can understand that it's really about cleaning the lens rather than changing the world.
Yeah. Wow. Mind blown. But I know I've definitely explored that because, you know, my father's been clean for over 20 years. And so I'm one of those people lucky enough to be able to have those conversations, let alone get the apology. But for me, for so long, I did some work in the sex and love addiction area too, because I had this conversation with my dad. And I said, per my recollection, it was the only time you validated me was going, wow, son, that's a really attractive woman you brought home. And it was like, you know, for me, and he's like, no, I used to tell you when you get good grades or you made the track team or whatever that I was proud of. None of it. Don't remember any of it.
Wow.
it's all blanks. That's the only thing that I recollected.
Yeah. And this is such an important conversation, and we'll get into what those five steps are in a moment. Yeah. But it's really important because we often will say something like, there's my version and your version, and the truth is in the middle. Mm. But the different way of looking at it is there's your version and my version, and they're both 100% correct, because it's our point of view that creates how we see it, right? And so we want to be really careful, because we know, like, for example, in a crime or something, eyewitnesses are kind of the least reliable.
Yeah.
Because we all see it through our own perspective, even literally where we're standing, right? Our lens, our point of view, is the way we see the world. And so when we believe, and this was true for me, I thought, I need to know exactly what happened. And once I know exactly what happened, I can be free from it. And then I realized it really is so much more about what I decided about myself than it is about what happened. And we would never want to say to someone, maybe that never happened. Like, we'd never want to discount that. We just want to acknowledge that, like, my five-year-old brain wasn't even developed enough to understand what was happening. My four-year-old brain. So I was taking all of this stuff on, and then I have a memory. Whether it happened or not, the memory is alive within me, and it's creating the same scenarios over and over and over again.
Yeah, and I don't know about you. I was and still am a very imaginative person.
Yeah.
And with the part of the brain where the memory sits and the imagination are, like, I will ask my brother or my best friend that I've known since I was 3 years old, like, about certain stuff, because in my head, a lot of stuff was probably bigger than the reality of what happened.
I'll give you a perfect example. My friend Brian, and I loved this story. I'm like, Brian, I'm going to be using this because it's so poignant. He said he used to do piano recitals when he was a kid. And one time he was on a really big stage. It was a really big recital for him. And he was playing and he froze. And he said at that moment, it was the first time he felt a deep sense of shame, and he froze for like a minute and then finally kept playing and just walked away with all this shame. Recently, years and years, or decades later, someone showed him the recording of it. He actually didn't freeze. But in his mind, whatever happened, in his mind and his memory, he froze. So my guess is he did freeze internally, but he believed he literally froze. And so we don't want to say something like, see, it never happened, no big deal. But what we want to say is, isn't it interesting that you've been carrying this around for so long, and this has become like your core idea of yourself,
yeah,
when in truth, it didn't really actually even happen that way. So let's explore what you took on more than what happened.
Right. Wow. That's fascinating. And I'm guessing that falls back into, let's return to movie, that process of making peace with the past, that you know, because oftentimes the shame or embarrassment that we carry isn't like, it's that looking external at what others think of us.
Yeah. Well, so the acronym is MOVIE, and it's M, making peace with the past. And at some point, I used to say forgiveness, and of course, FOVIE doesn't make a great acronym. Let's start with that, right? So FOVIE doesn't make sense. But forgiveness is such a loaded word, and it's loaded in the idea of good and bad, right? Like, you've done this thing that's unforgivable, but I have to somehow rise above it to forgive you. But making peace is something different. It's regardless of what happened, whether I consider it to be horrific, it's not about letting the person off the hook or keeping them on the hook. It really is about, gosh, I'm still carrying this. I remember I facilitated a workshop and invited people just to hold a backpack full of rocks while they told stories from their past. And at the end of the story, I just asked, do you want to put the backpack down now? Are you ready to let go of the heaviness of that story? And our minds can be such tricksters, but it happened. And I can be sometimes provocative and say, well, you can actually change the past. And what I mean by that is, it's just a story we have, like we've already talked about, like whether it happened or not. We're not trying to be dismissive of the experience, but to say, what if the story I've been carrying around, I can have a different relationship with, go back, have a different conclusion, and therefore, in a way, we change reality because the story no longer has power over us. And that's really making peace with the past, letting go or living beyond the weight of that story.
Yeah. Well, and tell me how it played out for you. I find that that's where the making peace part, where the value has come in my wrongdoing and errors, is when I can go share with other men and women who too have suffered from addiction or recently shared at a classroom of juniors and seniors, and it resonated with them. Something in my story, in some way, shape, or form, where it resonated, and it's given others maybe a peace of mind too, to give themselves permission to move forward from these things, or to simply say, you know, hey, this person, it violated me when I was a child, says nothing about who I am now as an adult, and didn't say anything to me about as a child either. That's not my burden to bear.
And if you're willing to dive in, just based on what you said, a topic that's been so relevant in my life is sexual trauma, and it's so nuanced. And I've been putting some things out about my own sexual trauma and kind of coming out of the closet a little bit about it. I've talked about it for years, but I think it's an important thing, especially for men.
There are
so many layers, and I shouldn't say especially for men, because obviously sexual trauma affects everyone very deeply. But we end up with this idea when we're just focused on the person doing the wrong thing, which of course that's true, but we want to look at, like, again, what I said, like, what did I decide about myself? Mm-hmm. And the young brain isn't developed enough to understand what's happening in many cases. So we either freeze or we run away, right? That's that flight. But we create these massive conclusions about ourselves, and they're really not thoughts. They're really much more of a deep wound that becomes shame. And then a lot of times people blame themselves. And I just put out a video recently, said, perhaps the thing that we want to stop saying to people, and this is a little controversial, I guess, is to say to someone, it wasn't your fault. Because I understand the spirit of that, but that alone doesn't change the experience, because as little kids, our brains are wired for, like, if mommy's yelling at me, I must be bad. It's not logical, but that's that young brain, right? Mm-hmm. Mommy's happy, I'm a good person. So when a sexual trauma happens, sometimes we end up thinking, I wanted that, I caused that, I did that. Not to mention, you can add the layer that sometimes people derive pleasure from it as well as shame. And then it becomes very, very deep and a lot to unpack. And I think if we just say, it's not your fault, that person was a bad person, that doesn't really heal. That's true. Right? We can say that's true, but it doesn't really heal the wound that's there. And it's now our job to heal that. I know people who haven't let go of the quote unquote perpetrator, and the person isn't even alive, right? And so they're still giving all their power to that person. And we're not saying it was okay, it happened, but we want to look at, what were those core decisions? And now I get to reparent myself. And that's a whole process.
Yeah. Well, and I give me your take on this. I've found that it, in doing some group work in that area and talking about my sexual traumas, that I was seeing two results. One was the just sexual withdrawal, and then the sexual overly active. And I think that's what most people probably think, but I saw so much withdrawal completely too. Yeah. Which I was very surprised.
Yeah. And in my case, and in some people's cases, there's also a separation of love and sex, right? Mm. So, like, I didn't combine those two until I was almost 40. So there's a lot of things that come out of that, but we want to look, and this is where the kind of, like, at the core of my work, so much of what we focus on when we talk about trauma healing or addiction, we focus so much on the symptoms and we want to get down to the root cause, right? So the core false belief, the frequency, what I call core false belief, and then I call BS brilliant strategies, right? Which is hypersexuality, separating love and sex, shutting down sexually. Those are all strategies. We tend to think of them as coping mechanisms, but I don't want people to cope. I want us to thrive and live and reconnect with that beautiful place within ourselves. And when we look at that was the best I could do at the time, we take the shame out of it because shame doesn't heal shame.
Yeah. I like that. I'm going to steal that, the best I could do at that time, if I may.
Right. And it was brilliant. Yeah. So like, trust me, weed and alcohol at age 14 was the most brilliant thing I've ever done. Well, I hope that's not true. It was the most brilliant thing I had done to that point, right? Because I was walking around. I remember being a little kid and I remember being so happy. And I actually have a memory of when that sensation or that experience of being connected and filled with love ended. And I built a wall around my heart at age 7. So from 7 to 14, it was very painful to be alive. It was painful just in my body. I can almost feel the way it felt then, like so shut down, so afraid, so closed off. And, you know, we'd helped with that and it worked for a while. Alcohol helped with that. So they are brilliant strategies. Then we can start saying, are they brilliant now? And is it getting me what I really desire?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's interesting how the resonance that I was putting out. I've had a couple conversations. I'll go to Celebrate Recovery. I really enjoy it because I've explored my Christianity and my sobriety. And I was talking with a young man, and I was talking about frequencies and vibrations, and he was like, "Oh, it's a little bit too much." I'm like, "Really? We're just talking about Christianity. Like, have you read the Bible? Me talking frequencies and what we resonate's a little too much. Go back and read this whole thing. Here, that's a gnarly story."
Yeah, and those words, you know, sometimes it can be like, "Oh, that's so California." All right, but really, energy and frequency is very much like animals are very in touch with their own energy. Right, a dog will sense. You know, that's why equine therapy is so powerful. Horse picks up on your energy. It's not really how you're standing or how you're looking at them, right? So that really is something that many of us have had taught out of us. Yep. We come into the world as these beautiful, wide open, intuitive beings connected with our essence. And then we start getting programmed. And, you know, for most of us, we start putting stuff on top of that light, if you will.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I know we're going to get through movie here at some point. You just keep throwing out gems that just bring up so many questions for me. Let's just start with you. How did you start to accept that about yourself that, hey, I'm getting out of life the energy that I'm putting out that is related to the story that I tell myself about myself and what my worth is?
Well, 18 months sober, I was suicidal. And the paradigm at that time, and we've evolved a lot. I got sober in 1986. I felt like I could no longer be alive, basically. And the paradigm at the time sounded like this. Don't worry about anything but not drinking. Your life is a miracle. Now go help someone else. And I was like, okay, but I want to die. And what do I do with this? Right. And I met this woman. Her name is Mary Helen. And she passed away in 1998, but was just like this beautiful, enlightened being. And she ultimately, I rarely tell this part, but she ultimately wrote the Hazelden Fourth Step Guide. And she got sober in 1957. And she said, no one at that time was really doing a lot of deep work. They were just like going to meetings and not drinking. And there wasn't a lot of focus on healing. And John Bradshaw came along in the 80s and was like, what about shame, right? And it's wild. It was controversial then, like 12-step. Right? Within 12-step communities, they were like, oh, that guy, you know, and it was just, it was very rigid back then. And so I went on a journey with her that was twofold. One, it was reconnecting or spending some time remembering a time before the trauma. In other words, it wasn't an outer focus. It was, gosh, there's still this preciousness within me. And I haven't had access to it for you know, 15 years or whatever it was. And then it was pretty much, and we hear this a lot, but it's pretty much unlearning everything I've ever believed that's counter to that. All these ideas of limitation and lack and shame. So that experience of walking through that with her, doing the empty chair work, doing the inner child work, just sitting with her for hours, she was just a phenomenal human. And I started to realize that if I'm tuning into my true nature, life is pretty beautiful and in a really pretty simple way. It's not that complicated. I know that I'm whole and perfect underneath all of this. I know that I came in that way. When I know that, I have more love and connection in my life. When I believe the lies of limitation, brokenness, I'm not good enough, that's what I experience. And it was like instant. Now, I'm not going to say it instantly changed everything, but that awareness was like, oh my gosh, I'm the creator of my life. And that's why I start with the M, because, you know, people want to jump into goal setting without like looking at like, what's the stuff I'm carrying, like trying to paint over an old canvas, but it's just going to keep bleeding through. Sorry to use a mixed metaphor there. I'm moving hand to canvas, but
that's all right. I love it. And I'm so glad you spoke about brokenness, because it's a word that I think is overused that I have an issue with.
Yeah.
This, you are broken. No, yeah. You might have some of the wrong tools. You've been in survival mode. You've adopted ways of being to survive. I know I did. People hate when I say this sometimes. Hey, alcohol helped me survive. I'm sorry, it just did. And there was a period in my life, guess what? Pornography did too.
Right.
And hey, you know, it's not the best way of being, and it certainly would have taken me somewhere else, but it kept me from probably more times in which I would have tried to have taken my own life.
Exactly. Like, and what do we do? Because that's that existential crisis. And, you know, I remember getting sober and looking at like the cross section of people coming into recovery and like with various different stories of like, and this old idea that we have to lose, you know, I'm going to use the old book, but you have to lose everything in order to be willing. It's like, no, people reach a place of spiritual bankruptcy. And at that place of spiritual bankruptcy, it's like, okay, I'm ready to try something different. And when you talk about the brokenness, it's so foundational to me. As a matter of fact, my book, Conscious Recovery, the foundational principle is underneath all addictive behavior is an essential self that is whole and perfect, mm-hmm. Right? The opposite of broken. And it became so simple for me. And I discovered something. I'm like, simple is always so much, there's so much power in it. When I believed I was broken, I acted broken. So 100% of the time I've caused harm in the world and to myself, which had been plenty, it's because I believed I was broken. So this idea that somehow believing we're broken is going to help us heal, it's incongruent, right? Yeah. And the idea that I want to remember how bad it got so I won't repeat it. But really, it's like, let's go back before the trauma. Mm-hmm. Remember that as the starting point. Then start to like work on recovery from that place.
Yeah. Thank you, TJ. I appreciate that. And just to let you know, I do have the books on Audible, so I'm working through them. So I'm going to be reaching out again here. I just know it for sure. Where were we at in movie? I think
we didn't get to O yet.
Oh, let's jump into O.
The good news is we've been talking about it. So the M and the O are what I call the clearing steps. So making peace with the past, and then O is overcoming core false beliefs. So we have been talking a lot about it. And that is not I have to let go of all my beliefs or I have to change my beliefs, because I spent a decade both in spiritual community and in recovery circles trying to change the narrative, trying to change my thinking. I remember learning to meditate. And I was like, so brutal with myself, thinking my mind should stop. And so when I say overcoming core false beliefs, it is these beliefs, these ideas about myself no longer have power over me. Mm. It's just like we're starting to discover now that our DNA, we can change our relationship with our DNA. I mean, it's such an exciting time we're living in, where science and spirituality are starting to like come to the same conclusion. Yeah. So I feel very, very happy about that.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Yes. It's such an exciting time. I remember the first time that someone had a guest here on this podcast. It stuck with me afterwards, and they're like, "You do know you can totally rewire your brain." What? Like, yeah, you can rewire all your neural pathways. Yeah. And then pulled up a video. I'm like, "Holy Jesus! Wow, really? I can do that too?" Like, "Oh yeah, yeah, you
Holy
can."
Holy Jesus! Wow. Yeah. because here's the thing, and that, you know, I try to be controversial at least once in every show, so I'm going to lean in, and this could be controversial in some circles. We tell people that we have a genetic predisposition to alcohol. Mm. I've heard people tell horrific stories and then literally at the end of the horrific story say, but that's not why I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because I have the disease of alcoholism. And so it's like we're dismissing what we know to be true. There's a connection. And I don't think there's one cause of addiction. I think it's so multi-layered. So do we have a genetic predisposition? Quite possibly. Is our, because, you know, now we're calling it a brain, you know, a brain disorder. In the, you know, so great. If it's a brain disorder, the good news is we can change the brain. That is so exciting. And what science is saying is that we change the brain by having repetitive behavior. That's where the term getting stuck in a groove came from. Mm. Do it over and over and over again. Like, we don't think about the way we brush our teeth. It's automatic. How much is automatic? But if we try it the new way, it's really uncomfortable, but ultimately it becomes easy. But I think it's really much deeper than that. And that brings the spiritual room into it, because it's that core decision, that core vibration. Mm-hmm. When I believe I'm broken, those are the neural pathways that are getting that's the groove. When I start to have a different conclusion, or at least question all of that, I create new neural pathways. So it's not only behavior that changes the brain, it's consciousness itself.
Yeah. Have you dug into the archives of past Knocking Doors Down podcast episodes? The Knocking Doors Down podcast archive is available to you for free. Check it out. Here's a snippet from when Charlie Sheen was on the podcast.
AA is not the best place for a famous atheist. I kept looking for that fucking chapter. What, you know? So yeah, but it's not a one size fits all.
Sure,
you know, it's like saying that we all think the same, like our brains are built the same. They're just not.
Right. Yeah.
There's such uniqueness involved.
Check out this episode and so many more in the Knocking Doors Down archive. And while you're at it, hit that subscribe button, give this video a thumb up, leave a comment, and share with somebody else that you know will get value out of the Knocking Doors Down podcast.
Oh, well, I know that you're on wholehearted.org, and there's so many other brilliant people up there, and I found it interesting what Dr. Gabor Maté was saying. You know, when people can't do his voice too well, though, people talk all about just the disease or however he sounds.
Yeah.
The addiction as a disease, but he really talked about the body response.
Yeah.
And I think that what you're saying is so important. Like, do not separate your physical being, your mental being, and your spiritual being.
That's right.
All three of these things were broken for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I use the acronym PIES: physical, intellectual, emotional, spiritual. It's like a piece of the pie. And most of us hang out in one room more often, and a lot of recovery circles. Well, in the recovery industry, if you will, the most of the focus is on the brain now. So it's mostly that intellectual room, and some with the emotions, like, what are you feeling? But the physical and the spiritual, which seem like on the opposite ends, are the least, I feel like they're the least addressed in treatment. Like, sometimes it's like, you know, changing your diet and doing exercise. But the spiritual room is like, when did you separate from who you really are?
Right.
And that's what I mean by spiritual disconnection. I'm not talking about disconnecting from a higher power, although that can be part of it. I'm saying we came in as a spark of this divinity, and it's still who we are. But at some point, we believe we separated from it, or we started believing the lie instead of the reality. So recovery is about a journey back toward that. Yeah. And that room is not often addressed in recovery circles.
Agreed. I think somebody, I can't remember how they put it, I imbibe spirits and it kept my spirit away. Something like that.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's called spirit, right?
Right.
Spirits.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Because it is, there, you know, there it is. We were seeking that outside of ourselves. And like we said, it was brilliant in the beginning, but we all know we wouldn't be sitting here doing this podcast right now if it were still brilliant. Because you don't call it addiction as long as it's working, you call it fun. Right. Yeah. Right. Very simple.
Well, let's jump to visioning.
Yeah. So the V in the movie acronym is visioning. And I want to always acknowledge my good friend, Michael Beckwith, who created the life visioning process. And I always say, if you want to go deeper into it, get his book, Life Visioning, because he's brilliant. And visioning is really different than visualization. So really common and popular in our culture now is the law of attraction. Make the vision board. You put what you want. You hold that thought. You manifest it. That's all fun. That's not what I'm talking about. Visioning is once we've done these clearing steps, making peace with the past, overcoming core false beliefs, we spend time in the silence and we listen to what was once referred to as the still small voice. Once we really start trusting it, it becomes the predominant way of living, right? Mm-hmm. So for many of us, it's like a hunch, an inspiration, a divine idea. But as we practice it formally using Michael's process, it's, no, I spend dedicated time in the silence and I ask a series of questions and I listen for the intuition. In other words, we're shifting from a mind-based reality or even an emotional or heart-based reality. We're getting into that room of spirit and we're living in that room of spirit with curiosity, yeah. Not I have an idea of what my life should look like. It's like, huh, I wonder what's the highest possibility now.
Right. And I loved when you had said that. That resonated with me. What is the highest possibility now? Yeah. It's such a great question to ask of oneself.
Yeah. And that's Michael's question. I want to definitely give him credit. That's the first question in the visioning process. You quiet to the best of our ability, present with ourselves, allow ourselves to think, feel, drop in, move into the silence, and then ask the first question, which is, what's the highest possibility for my life right now? Or what's the highest possibility for our relationship? You can do it with your partner. What's the highest possibility for our business? A lot of different ways you can do it.
Yeah. And I was definitely a person that, you know, my father was a high achiever as an addict, did very well financially. And so I compared myself to that for a long time. And it wasn't until probably the last 6 months that I just kind of sat in a place and looked at how I was generating the means that I earn and going, just finding a real peace with it. No, I'm not a millionaire. And no, I'm not a household name. But gosh, I always get some sort of feedback of someone, thanks for what you do. It helped me, or, you know, I connected to this person that you spoke with, or I provide Narcan for the nonprofit that I work for. Hey, thanks. Or, you know, so it's just, I just removed certain things from the rubric, if you will, of the external gauge, as opposed to how do I feel in what I'm doing?
Yeah. And the exciting thing about visioning that's different than visualization is, have a divine idea that comes from it's much more connected with our purpose. I could phrase that like, ooh, that seems like a really big idea. That seems really different than what my mind tells me. I trust that, then everything starts to unfold with grace and ease. I'm not fighting or struggling. And then ultimately it becomes bigger than anything I could have created on my own.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's jump into the last two, intentions and embodying the vision.
Yeah. Setting, it's just really practical. My friend Gregory Spencer gave me this really cool process that he'd been doing for years where you like, what are the goals? And the goals come from the intention. From you set intentions, very clear. 3 months from now, this is what I see for myself, using affirmations and using the positive, you know, the conscious language, which is seeing it already done with the E, but we're going to bleed into that. There's accountability piece. I've been doing this process, for more than 15 years. So every single Monday, by Monday morning, him my action items that are the steps that I've done, the visioning, what came through, the intentions that I've set every item. So it's very, very practical. So you set it, intentions that you get from the vision, and they need to be specific, measurable, realistic, but a stretch. And, you know, with conscious creation, I have a whole workbook where you get to write this out. And, you know, the discipline, I guess, if you will, of staying with it. I remember that when I first started, I thought, well, I want to write a book. And I went into the visioning process, and a date 18 months later came to mind. And I wrote that down on such and such date, which was 2015. I think it was June 1st, 2015. My first book will be published. And it was actually published 2 weeks before that. And there were a lot of action steps that led to it, but it was holding that vision too, and knowing that when, as it, because it came as a divine idea and it wasn't something that I created in my mind, everything, because when the intentions come from vision, we know we have everything within us to fulfill, and the universe will support that.
Yeah. Well, and it's that importance of if you don't put it out there, then how's it ever, you know, this was funny because when I was thinking about talking to you, I pulled out, I have a card in my wallet that has roughly how many days left I have if I live towards the average age of a U.S. male, and how many days and years. And it's these 10 things that I want to achieve. And some of them had come true. Ironically, one of them was to interview Alonzo Bowden, one of my favorite comedians in long-term recovery. And a friend of mine, she reached out and goes, "Hey, I recently met Alonzo Bowden, told him about your podcast. Would you like to talk to him?" She didn't amazing. Know that. She never saw this list.
Yeah, that's so amazing. Yeah, and that's the power. That's actually, we're moving right into E, which is embodying the vision. Yeah. We start to hold that as a frequency, as if it's already happened. And so I want to be clear, because there's so much out there with the law of attraction that's like, deny anything that's negative, only hold positive thoughts, create your reality. I'm talking about something much deeper here. I'm talking about knowing very deeply that this came from vision, knowing very deeply that because it came from this deep intuition, from this spirit, deep spiritual place, that the intentions I've set around being from this purest place of being a maximum world, like making a difference, right? And embodying that is just knowing that that's true, knowing that it's, I remember the first time I was visioning and Michael Beckwith, you know, as someone to connect with, and I didn't know him. And I won't go, I write about it in Conscious Creation, but ultimately he ended up reaching out to me. And it was just something that was caught in consciousness. And so, you know, dream big and hold the dream, because I'll say for myself, my ideas, usually much smaller than my idea coming from spirit, I mean more success or any of that. I just mean you're helping more people. Like the idea, I remember Mary Helen, who was my mentor, she was very introverted. She spoke one life. So in recovery circles, it's like you say no to speak. And she's like, well, what are you going to do? Throw me out? I say no.
I love her. And wish I could have met her.
Oh, she's amazing. And, end of her life, she said, you know, you're really extroverted and you're going to use that as a gift to deliver this message to more people than I could. And it was like, one, massive compliment, but two, it was also her passing the torch and saying, okay, this is what I want you to do, right? And so it took me a while to get yes for that. But once I realized, it's not about me. It's about how can this message get to more people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, goodness. Hey, we're going to have to do this again sometimes. There's so much more to dig into. You're such a fascinating person. And I mean this wholeheartedly. I'm glad you're in the world doing what you're doing, because I personally know people that have read your books as well and dug in, and, the impact, it's interesting, is oftentimes greater than we think.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, true. Hey, we're going to lighten it up with some random questions. How about it?
Let's do it.
All right. All the information for TJ, his books, what he's doing at wholehearted.org is in the podcast description. So please, as well, give him a follow on social media. let's see, what's one that I haven't done in a while? Oh, well, what's your go-to song to sing? Be it in the shower, the car?
My goodness. So interesting. It is true. This song is true. And I don't know if I've ever said it out loud, but it was a song from my early recovery. And the artist was actually new recovery. And it was 1986. And it's Think About It, There May Be Higher Love. I just love that song. A song that reminds me, if I ever get bogged, to like remember that there's a higher vibration that I can tap into at any moment.
Ah, I love it. That is a great song.
Gabriel, am I getting it right?
What's that?
It's Peter Gabriel, right?
Yeah. Oh, great stuff. You're right. Brilliant song. Lately, mine's been Kisses, I Was Made for Loving You. But
you go. Love was in both of our titles. That's important.
Yes, sir. So what maybe hobby or interest that you don't talk about often might people be interested to find out about?
You know, it's so interesting. And this, I almost hesitate to say it. Like, I don't really, my work, my life's work is my hobby. It is my passion. Like, I love connecting with people. There's nothing I love more than, like, it's like a three-legged stool, speaking, facilitating, and being on podcasts or TV shows, like spreading this message. That's what brings me the greatest joy. But like in my personal life, it's like chill evenings with my husband and our dog and just, you know, watching the shows that we watch. That really fills me up. But it really is about human connection and feeling that purpose of doing my work.
What breed of dog do you guys have?
Half rat terrier, half dachshund.
Oh, I love it.
He's a little crazy. Yeah. He lets the neighborhood know he's in charge.
Okay. If a movie was made about you, your life, who would you want to play adult you?
Oh my goodness. I have no way to answer that. And I'm going to just be really, very transparent with you. I live in West Hollywood. I don't know who any celebrities. I don't watch mainstream movies. I do know a few people, but like, I don't even know who that would be. I have no idea. I have no way of answering that.
I think that's a brilliant answer. I love that answer.
It's so funny because like I remember like I was on a flight recently and someone was like stopping to get pictures taken with the person sitting next to me. I'm like, I have no idea who he is. But, you know, when you're flying to and from L.A., celebrities are on your flight sometimes. But which is great because then, you know, because I just get to be human with everyone and not have this idea of like less than or better than.
Yeah, it's funny. I was sitting on. I guess this person was an MMA fighter, but not at the UFC level yet. But I had spoken at a conference in Wisconsin, and on the way back, and I'm just sitting here talking to this guy, and then I noticed people were taking pictures, and then this guy comes over and goes, "Hey, do you know who that is?" And I go, I think his name was Rob. I can't remember. I go, "I don't know, just some gentleman I sat down next to." No, last night he won like the state title, and I'm like,
oh, wow.
Oh, okay. You know, he seemed like a nice person to converse with. Okay.
There you go. Exactly.
Okay. One last one for you here. You're stranded on a deserted island. You have one movie, one music artist, greatest hits, and one book. What would they be?
I have answers for this one. It's a miracle. So the first, my very favorite movie of all time is Baraka. And then the sequel to it was Samsara. So most people won't know those. So it's something for people to look up. They are an experience. So the first one came out in like 91 or 92. And Samsara, I don't remember. But those are my two favorite movies. If I have to choose one, I guess it's Baraka. My artist, absolutely Tori Amos. I'm in love with her. I had a chance to meet her. She is so incredible to me. And just, I'm a little bit of a fangirl with her. I know. And then the third one is what's the third one?
Book.
Oh, book. I'm going to say A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle.
All right. I saw Tori Amos in San Francisco when I was living there. And she just amazing performance. This one gal kept yelling out, I forget what song it was. And she just goes, pardon me, this is the quote. She goes, "Bitch, would you shut the fuck up so I can keep doing this show for these people?"
That's and then very she went Tory.
into And then she went into Sugar, which is my favorite song from her.
One of my favorites. So I, yeah, you know, I used to live in, I lived in San Francisco for 30 years.
Oh, okay.
I've seen her there so many times, and she's just a remarkable human, and her music inspires me. And a lot of people will say, oh, her music's so depressing. To me, it really isn't. It's really very healing because it comes from a very deep place.
Yeah. And that's what resonated with me so much about that song, Sugar, was the story behind it when she shared it. And I'll let people look that up because we could probably get another 20-minute conversation about that. Absolutely. But it was such a beautiful, I mean, words and music coming together in such a wonderful way that it's, you know, yeah, that song sits with me.
Mm. Yeah, my friend, I'll give you a short story, but my friend worked for Alice Radio, and he said, if you ever want a favor, just let me know. And I'm like, anything Tori Amos. So the phone rings one day, and I thought, he's going to give me tickets to Tori Amos, which I'm going to be grateful for. He's like, no, there's going to be, come to the W Hotel tomorrow, bring one friend, you and 15 people are going to sit with her in a grand piano, and we're going to do this Alice Live event. She's going to be live on radio. And I was literally sitting on the floor, and like, we got to hang out and talk, and like, you know, just she's remarkable.
I love it.
Tori, if you're watching, thank you for being you.
I double that. TJ, I'm so glad we got to connect. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much, Jason. I have loved this and absolutely would love to come back for a part two.
Yes. And if I get down your way, I'll have to give you a heads up. Would love to converse with you in person. But this is where I give you the floor. Anything that you would want to add, lend, maybe if somebody is struggling, a loved one of theirs is struggling?
Yeah, I tend to say a version of pretty much the same thing because it's so true for me. And that is, if no one has told you today, you are a whole and perfect being, no matter what's happened to you or whatever you've done. The truth of your being is a whole and perfect being, and you do deserve a life filled with love and connection because it's who and what you are.
Oh, I love it. On that note, everybody, keep knocking doors down.